They wrote, male subject, neutralized at checkpoint. His mother couldn't even identify him from photos. His face was gone. She knew him only by the scar on his ankle from when he fell out of a tree at 7. He was 12. His backpack held math homework and a half-eaten sandwich. In Silwan, settlers photographed a girl crying outside of her demolished home. One muttered, future terrorist. She was 9. In Ofer Prison, Interrogation Room 7B, a boy sits, 14 hours without water. The guards laugh when he asks for his dad. The law calls him a security threat. The law says a Palestinian is old enough to be a man at 13. What does it mean when a child is never allowed to be a child? This is Palestine Exists. Welcome back. Hi everyone, it's Hiba. Let's begin. I want you guys to listen to how they describe Palestinian children when they die. Teen killed in clashes. He was 13. Youth shot near settlement. She was 11. Militant neutralized. He was 14. Never child, always something else. We all know language shapes reality. Before the bullet, before the checkpoint, even before the prison cell, they strip away the word child, and suddenly everything else becomes so much easier to explain away. You see it in the headlines. They're never written as Israeli soldier kills child. Instead, it's child dies in clashes. The actor disappears. Or you'll see them leaning on a passive voice. Youth killed during operation. Killed by whom? And then there's this manipulation of age. 13 becomes teen or young man. Let's compare these real headlines. Palestinian youth dies in clash with IDF. Versus Israeli child murdered in terrorist attack. Same age, different words, different worlds. And behind every bloodless headline sits actual policy. Since 2000, Israeli forces have arrested more than 10,000 Palestinian children in the West Bank alone. 500 to 700 kids every year processed through military courts. And these courts? The judge wears the same uniform as the soldier who arrested the kid, where conviction rates hit 99.7%. Higher than North Korea, by the way, if anyone's keeping score. And where children plead guilty because fighting them means longer sentences. The whole choreography never changes. 2 a.m. raid, boots on tile, wrists zip-tied, a child blindfolded in front of his family. And from that very first second, it becomes clear. You don't have a son anymore, you have a suspect. A boy in Hebron told researchers about his arrest. They emptied my backpack on the ground. My books, my pencil case, my math homework. The soldier looked at my notebook and asked why I had drawn a Palestinian flag in the corner. I said it was just a drawing. He ripped out the page and put it in a plastic bag, like it was a weapon. And before they even touch the body, they've already changed the words. Palestinian children don't come into this world guilty. They're made guilty through language, through courts, through policies designed to criminalize their existence from the very moment that they draw breath. And this erasure has names. It has faces. It has last words. Remember Hindrajab? 5 years old, trapped in a shot-up car in Gaza. She was the only one left alive, hiding between her family's bodies. For hours, she stayed on the phone with emergency dispatchers. I'm so scared, she whispered. Everyone around me is gone. An ambulance tried to reach her, and Israeli forces opened fire on it. The medics never made it. And by the time rescuers found her days later, she was still in that car, a small body next to larger ones. When news of Hind's death broke, Western headlines first called her a young woman before correcting it to 6-year-old girl. It was reflex. It was the automatic aging up of Palestinian bodies, even ones small enough to still have her baby teeth. Erase the word child, and every violent act becomes administratively legible. If you remove the word, suddenly there's no contradiction between protecting children and shooting them. But this language doesn't just exist in headlines. It structures courts, their classrooms, their checkpoints, a system where childhood itself becomes conditional. A few months ago, I saw footage from Hebron that still haunts me. Little kids, maybe 5 or 6, standing in line at a checkpoint. Their tiny little backpacks were open and shoes were scuffed, and you have these soldiers towering over them with their rifles. And the kids, they weren't crying. They weren't even speaking. They've learned the dance. Stand still, stay quiet, and wait for permission to exist on the other side. For these kids, that checkpoint becomes everything. It doesn't just like block their route. It devours their morning, it shrinks their world, and it teaches their body from the very start that they are something suspicious. So picture yourself at 10, your backpack on, lunch packed, excited for recess. Now imagine a soldier with a Ukrainian accent and a rifle decides if you even make it to school. Sammy, an 11-year-old from East Jerusalem, told interviewers, "I wake up an hour earlier than I need to because you never know how long the checkpoint will take. Sometimes 15 minutes, sometimes 2 hours. I've been late to school 23 times this year. My teacher doesn't even count it against me anymore. He gets it." The occupation restructures a child's relationship to time and space. Their day gets built around checkpoints, around soldiers' moods, around a system designed to teach them from the earliest age that their time has no value and that their education can be revoked at any moment. But I keep thinking about what's underneath all this, what it's actually doing to these kids' bodies, because it's not just psychological anymore. Like, what happens when your whole childhood exists in a state of constant emergency? Scientists in Gaza have been measuring something we rarely talk about, the physical trace of occupation in children's bodies. They found it in their hair. Researchers tested cortisol levels in children's hair, the stress hormone that your body pumps out when you're in danger. So even during so-called ceasefire periods, these children's bodies stayed in crisis. They lived in a constant state of high alert month after month after month. Like, think about what that means for a 6-year-old's developing nervous system. The brain doesn't just think that there might be danger. It rewires itself to expect it constantly. Their bodies learn that there's no such thing as safety. Their hearts race faster all the time. They jump at every sound. They wet the bed. They sit in school but can't focus because their brain is too busy watching the door, the window, listening for drones. They get sick easily because their immune systems are exhausted from this constant alert. What science now understands is that this doesn't just pass. It sets itself into the body, into how things function. The brain literally rewires itself under this threat. Regions for fear processing, the amygdala, the hippocampus, grow oversensitive, hyperactive. This shows up in brain scans. It's visible. And the effects don't vanish when the bombing stops. What pediatricians and neurologists have documented in war zones is that these changes last decades into adulthood. Children who grow up under chronic siege show higher rates of hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, and shortened lifespans even just 50 years later. The occupation isn't just taking their childhood. It's stealing years from the other end of their lives too. Even sleep doesn't work the way that it should. Sleep just breaks down. And I don't just mean kids having nightmares. It's bigger than that. Sleep is supposed to be when your brain rests and sorts everything out, right? But children in Gaza don't just wake up tired. They wake up ready to run. Their nights and days blend into one long stretch of waiting for the next attack. So when doctors looked at their sleep patterns, they found that these kids barely get any deep sleep at all. That critical phase when your brain actually heals itself and processes your day. Without that, a child's brain can't develop properly. And how could you fully fall asleep when any sound might be a drone or any siren might be real? A teacher in Jabalia told researchers about Samir, the way he drops under his desk at any sudden sound and then pops up with an apology he learned somewhere, Sorry for jumping. Asif anni khifit. Sorry for getting scared. And when the alarm never shuts off, curiosity goes first. Curiosity is a luxury you need safety to afford. A child who can't risk curiosity can't project into the future. They can't imagine a job, a dream, or a life somewhere else. Think about this. When researchers asked children in Gaza about their lives, 49% of them said that they wanted to die. 96% believed that their death was imminent. More than half had contemplated suicide, and 3 out of 5 were self-harming. Let that sink in. This wasn't a single survey after one bombing. This was systematic research conducted across multiple locations using established clinical instruments during what the world called pauses. The research team initially thought that their instruments were flawed. The numbers were so extreme that they seemed impossible, that they messed up. They rechecked. They weren't wrong. Think about what it means when half of all children in a place say they want to die. This isn't distress or anxiety or even PTSD. The collapse of what psychologists call future orientation, the ability to see yourself existing later. Without it, the very things that make up childhood, learning, play, imagination, can't function. Numbers like these don't belong to a quote-unquote conflict. They belong to a place where the future tense has been confiscated. Go ask a 10-year-old anywhere else what they want to be when they grow up. And the answers bloom. Doctor, teacher, president. Ask in Gaza and you hear silence. Maybe a laugh at the absurdity of the question. Or one word. Alive. Clinical language calls this pervasive hopelessness. But the children call it planning. Planning for sirens, for the next displacement, for how to carry your cat. Planning isn't dreaming, it's surviving. And surviving devours the space where the future is supposed to grow. And that's why the suicide numbers matter. They show that when a society can't promise children sleep or safety or school, it can't promise adulthood either. In Gaza, psychologists watched children play during a research study. The kids weren't playing house or school. They played airstrike, lying on the ground, screaming for help, wrapping pretend wounds on each other's arms and legs. When asked why, one boy just shrugged. Because this is what happens to us. A social worker documented in a UNICEF report 2 boys who were pretending to be rescue workers. One kept saying, "Careful, careful," as they lifted an imaginary body from the rubble. They were 7 years old. You know, play should be where children try on different roles, where they imagine worlds that don't exist. But when your reality is bombing, when everyone you know has lost someone, play is bent by war, and it doesn't escape reality, it absorbs it. In Gaza, children's play turns into rescue work. Dirt is rubble. They pretend to dig each other out. They know words like triage and martyr, and sometimes they stage raids. And the funeral games are what break me every time. These kids wrap dolls in white cloth. They carry them through the same streets they carried their family members on. They know where the body goes, how it's held, and which prayers to recite. Even their drawings tell the same story. Fighter jets sketch in extreme detail, ambulances with bullet holes in them. And here's another layer of this. Childhood has market value. It's unevenly distributed, it's selectively protected, and it's deliberately withheld. For Israeli children, the state invests. Bunkers are built into every playground, the Iron Dome above their heads. Their childhood gets treated like a national resource, something worth billions to safeguard. But for Palestinian children, it's the opposite. Childhood is treated like contraband, like something dangerous. The state doesn't protect it. It works to end it before it can even take shape. Take Blue Wolf, Israel's facial recognition system that catalogs Palestinians, specifically children, into a massive database. Soldiers literally compete in games to photograph as many Palestinians as possible, and these military units set quotas for how many Palestinian faces to scan during shifts. Can you imagine being 10 years old, walking to school, and a soldier points a phone at your face? Before your voice even drops, before you lose all your baby teeth, you're already being tracked. A teenage girl in Hebron describes how it feels. They never ask permission, They just point the phone at you. If you try to turn away or cover your face, they get angry. They tell you to stop moving. Sometimes they make you take off your hijab so that they can see your whole face. It feels like they're stealing something from you. Because they are. I mean, they're stealing the assumption of innocence that should come with childhood. And then there's the medical blockade. Children in Gaza with cancer, with heart defects, with injuries from bombs that need permits to leave for treatments. Permits that are routinely denied or delayed. And children die waiting for these slips. Omar was 5 when diagnosed with leukemia in Gaza. His family applied for a permit to take him to a hospital in East Jerusalem. His first application was denied. His second was delayed. And his third was under review. Meanwhile, his condition deteriorated. His mother described the waiting. Every day he asked me, "When are we going to the hospital, Mama?" What could I tell him? That some soldier decided his life wasn't important? That his papers were sitting on someone's desk? I told him soon. I told him tomorrow. I lied to my dying son because the truth was too horrible. And by the time approval came, Omar was too weak to travel. He died without ever receiving the treatment that might have saved him. So childhood gets completely rewritten under occupation. The war doesn't end when bombing stops. It continues. Inside their hormones, their games, their drawings, inside their nightmares. And you don't outgrow the occupation. It outgrows you. So we've talked about the body of the child, the cortisol in their hair, the breakdown of sleep. But the body of a child is never isolated. It's inside a family, inside a history. And in Palestine, as we all know, history doesn't let go. Trauma doesn't stay in one generation. It's passed forward. Parents hand it to children, not because they want to, but because the occupation never gives them the time or the space to heal. Psychologists call this intergenerational trauma, and it sounds clinical, I know, but in Palestine, it's daily life. So picture a father who spent his teenage years in Israeli prison. He comes home quiet, unable to sleep, still waking at sudden noises. Or a mother who was displaced in 48, and then again in 67, and then again in 2008. She teaches her children to never unpack fully, to keep their bags near their door. She doesn't tell them that we're unsafe, but she lives it, and her children absorb it. One mother in Gaza told researchers, "I try not to cry in front of my children. I tell them that we are strong. But they see me wake up screaming at night. They see me search for my baby when the drones fly." A father said, "I want my son to feel free. But how do I teach him freedom when I've never lived it, not even for one day?" The Gaza Community Mental Health Program has been documenting this for decades. It hadn't been directly bombed. 2022 study found that parental trauma explained nearly half of the adjustment difficulties in children. Mothers' depressions or fathers' PTSD symptoms, all of it shows up in their children's behaviors and in their bodies. Another study found children's emotional distress strongly tied to maternal trauma, even when the child hadn't been directly bombed. Researchers call it secondary traumatization, but there's nothing secondary about it here. And this isn't unique to Palestine. Native communities in North America, descendants of enslaved people, survivors of genocide, all show the same mechanisms. Trauma, unhealed, embeds in families. Children don't just hear about it, they live its consequences in the present. But what makes Palestine distinct is that there is no post. In most war zones, trauma becomes memory and can sometimes be processed afterward. In Gaza, in the West Bank, there is no afterward. There's only another war. I read about a boy in Khan Yunis who repeated advice his grandfather gave him. "Never keep all your things in one place. Soldiers might take it." That grandfather was displaced in 48. 70 years later, the grandson spoke the same sentence word for word. And it isn't only fear that passes down, it's grief. A parent loses a home, a sibling, a childhood, and their child learns that grief is the baseline. And that's why the occupation is so devastating. It doesn't only crush a child in the present, it hijacks their inheritance. It ensures that parents who want nothing more than to shield their children end up passing forward the very fear that they hope to bury. A Palestinian psychiatrist once said, "I treat children for war trauma, but every time I meet the parents, I realize that they are untreated survivors too, and that the untreated survivors can't raise children who feel safe." And brain studies back this up. Trauma isn't just in memories. It changes stress hormone regulation. It alters attachment systems. It rewires your entire nervous system. These changes show up in parents' cortisol levels, in responses, in their immune function, and they correlate almost directly with their children's biology. Researchers studying families in Gaza have seen the same biomarkers in both parents and child, even when the child wasn't alive for the original trauma. So when we talk about childhood in Gaza, we're not talking about one generation of stolen childhood. We're talking about decades stacked on decades. A 12-year-old growing up now doesn't just carry 2025. They carry 2014, 2008, 1967, 1948. The trauma doesn't die with a generation. It waits in the body and then it passes forward. And that's the occupation's cruelest trick. It doesn't just destroy the present tense, it colonizes their future tense. Parents want to hand their children stories and traditions and hope. Instead, they hand them survival strategies and grief. Okay, I've been turning this question over and over in my head for months now. And it sounds so simple, but it reveals everything, I think. Who gets to be a child? Because, like, childhood isn't some natural state that just happens. It's a protected status. It's a permission to make mistakes without permanent consequences, a chance to imagine a future, an assumption of innocence. But for Palestinian kids, every single one of these protections gets stripped away by design. When a Palestinian child is killed, the media script follows a pattern. The headline never says, "Oh, a soldier shot a child." Instead, a child dies in clashes. The gun disappears, the shooter disappears, and only the dying remains. And they don't call him a child because then they'd have to explain why they shot him. Now compare this to how Israeli children appear in those same outlets. When an Israeli child is killed, we learn their name. We hear they love drawing or dancing or playing the piano. We see their bedroom with posters on the wall. We learn about their favorite foods or the birthday party that they were planning. But a Palestinian child, by contrast, becomes a statistic before they're even buried. If they're named at all, it often comes only after activists have forced the issue, demanding that the world see them as individuals with stories. Israeli children are named in life, in hobbies, favorite songs, the soccer jersey that they were wearing. Palestinian children get a body count. And there's something I've been struggling to articulate about cases like Ahmed Manasra's, something that happens to Palestinian children just beyond erasure. And I talked about it a bit in the Ahmed Manasra episode, but let me explain what I mean. Frozen childhood is what happens when a Palestinian child's most violated moment becomes their permanent identity. Symbols are easy to carry. Children are not. Symbols can be arranged to make a point. Children wake up at 3 a.m. and need water and a nightlight. The cost of freezing a child in symbolism is that living Palestinian kids watching learn a terrible lesson, that you matter when you die memorably. Ahmed Manasra didn't ask to be a symbol. He asked for his mom. The state made him a threat, and the world made him an emblem. Neither of us allowed him to be a boy trying to heal. Hind Rajab didn't volunteer her death. She asked to be rescued. And this is where the contrast with Israeli children becomes even more apparent. When Israeli children go through trauma, there's a system waiting to catch them. Therapists, school programs, community support, everything designed to help them rebuild a story where they can still grow up. They're allowed to evolve past their worst moment. Their trauma is treated like an event and not an identity. But Palestinian children are locked in the instant that they're broken. These seconds become their whole existence in the eyes of the world. No one asks who they might have been next year or what they might have grown into. Their lives are now collapsed into the violation itself. And once that happens, that they're not children anymore. They're not even people anymore. They're artifacts of harm held there so the rest of us can point and argue and move on. But it doesn't have to stay there. The remedy is narrative repair. putting children back at the center of their own stories, refusing to let their pain be passed around as public property, and insisting on their futures in the present tense. And that starts with how you choose to see them and how you choose to speak about them. But even the law denies them that. Two birthdays in the same land marks different legal worlds. Under Military Order 132, Palestinian majority begins at 16, Israelis, 18. So a boy arrested at 15 years and 11 months faces one track. At 16 years, 0 days, another. Lawyers in the West Bank describe cases where arrests are timed to this specific threshold. And what makes this so insidious is how it weaponizes developmental biology itself. The adolescent brain doesn't fully mature until the mid-20s, specifically the prefrontal cortex that's responsible for judgment and impulse control. And that's why juvenile justice systems exist globally, to acknowledge that children's brains are still developing. But the occupation's legal system short-circuits this for Palestinians only. It enforces a kind of premature adulthood, a legal fiction that says a Palestinian 16-year-old somehow possesses full adult judgment while an Israeli 16-year-old doesn't. This pattern extends beyond Palestine. A Georgetown law study on adultification bias found black girls are viewed as less innocent and more adult-like than their white peers beginning as early as age 5. The same happens to Palestinian children. They're seen as older, more calculating, and more threatening. In both cases, the child isn't allowed to be a child. Their basic developmental needs to play, to explore, to learn, even to test limits, all get classified as dangerous behaviors. And if they die, even their mourning becomes conditional. Palestinian children must pass tests to be properly grieved. They must be very young and obviously innocent. They can't be throwing rocks. They can't be used as human shields. They can't be sleeping in a refugee camp at 4 a.m. in the morning. Because we can't mourn them as children, because mourning them would require acknowledging that they had a childhood at all. So, who gets to be a child? Language becomes policy, and then in turn becomes permission. Change the word child to something else, and suddenly that protection disappears. So you explain away the killing, and nothing has to change. So if a 5-year-old in Sderot is a child, a 5-year-old in Gaza is a child, and if a 13-year-old in Tel Aviv is a child, a 13-year-old in Nablus is a child. You don't get to manufacture adulthood for one child because their death is inconvenient to your politics. So, again, who gets to be a child? And if the answer changes with ethnicity, passport, politics, then the problem isn't a definition, it's domination. And the fix isn't better adjectives, it's ending the system that needs those adjectives to function. And what's kept me going, even through all of this research, is seeing how Palestinian children resist erasure in the most ordinary ways. And as children do, as naturally, inherently as breath, they push back against this erasure every single day, not as symbols or icons, but in the most ordinary moments, in drawings made with stubbly crayons, or in bedtime stories that they ask to hear again and again and again, in games they invent on rooftops. A boy in Balata camp told researchers something so simple and so powerful. "We want to live as other children live." He knows what childhood should be, and he knows he's being denied it. Zionism can't afford to see Palestinian children as children, because a child who remembers becomes an adult who resists. The occupation fears children as witnesses more than it fears them as fighters, because children see everything happening to their neighborhoods, their schools, their families, and they remember. When a 9-year-old sleeps with her grandmother's key under her pillow, she doesn't understand occupation policy or absentee property laws. She just knows something was taken and that key means it can come back. A girl in a refugee camp described her grandmother's house, demolished before she was even born. It had blue shutters. There was a lemon tree in the yard. The kitchen had a red tile floor. When asked how she knew these details so perfectly, she said, "My grandmother told me every night before bed so I wouldn't forget." Can you picture that bedtime ritual? A grandmother who's lost everything whispering to her granddaughter about blue shutters, about a lemon tree, just so someone else will remember the home that she loved. And what makes memory so powerful as resistance is that it can't be controlled the way physical space can. They can take the house, the street, the land, but the memory of it stays. Parents hand it to their kids, and it keeps moving forward no matter what's destroyed. Memory has become the last uncolonized territory for Palestinians. It's the space where Palestinians can still move freely, the place that can't be occupied, the homeland that can't be taken, whether in refugee camps, exile, or occupation. And that's why soldiers seize diaries or confiscate drawings and delete pictures on your phones. When Israeli authorities raid children's art exhibitions or censor textbooks that mention the Nakba, they don't care about controlling speech. They're attempting to disrupt this collective memory that substitutes statehood itself. These ordinary memories of the dekene that sold ice cream, of the tree that shaded the playground, or the mural on the school wall, it becomes exactly what the occupation tries hardest to erase, because a child who remembers how things were becomes a witness to what's been taken. It's the most damning evidence against the quote-unquote empty land myth. How can the land have been empty if children can name each street corner? How can ownership be disputed when a child can describe the exact pattern of tiles on her grandmother's kitchen floor? In Aida refugee camp, children created a small museum in 2017, just a community space where they displayed objects from their villages that their families were expelled from. Farming tools, embroidery, photographs, and even bottle caps. A 13-year-old who helped organize this explained, "I want to know what our village looked like. I want to touch the things my great-grandfather touched. I want to know the name of every street, every well, every hill. If I forget, then it's like our village never existed." And when soldiers raided the camp, they confiscated some of these items. After Israel killed four boys playing soccer on a Gaza beach in 2014, Ahed, Zakaria, Muhammad, and Ismail Bakr, all cousins between the ages of 9 and 11, their surviving friends formed a team. They named it after their dead friends, and they played on the same beach. These boys didn't make speeches or write manifestos. They just kept playing soccer where their friends had died. One of them, Mahmoud, who was 10 at the time, told a reporter something so simple. "We play here because this is our beach. This is where we always played. And this is where our friends were. If we play somewhere else, it's like forgetting them." This is where Palestinian resistance diverges from any other liberation struggle I can think of. Remembering and belonging becomes the primary mechanism through which Palestinians remain Palestinians, despite displacement, despite occupation, despite erasure. In this sense, a child's memory becomes more dangerous to the occupation than any weapon, because while weapons can be confiscated, borders can be sealed, protests can be crushed, memory persists, it regenerates, it passes from grandmother to grandchild in bedtime stories, and it moves from exile to homeland in letters and phone calls. And every time that memory survives, the occupation fails. And that's where we end each week, with names, with stories, with memory that refuses to die even when the bodies do. This is Humanize Gaza. Their names are Sidra and Suzanne Hassouna, twins, 7. They liked to trade hair clips. Sidra loved the color yellow, and Suzanne said that she didn't care, but then she ended up wearing the yellow anyways. They fought over a plastic tea set once that was missing a cup, and their cousin fixed it by pouring pretend tea into his palm and saying, "Look, I'm the cup." That's how they played, improvising around what was missing. One night in Rafah, the game stopped. Bombs turned seconds into rubble, and by morning the family was gone. Parents, their baby brother, a door that never stopped shaking. News reported, "Super Bowl strike in Rafah, casualties, civilians," but not Sidra, not Suzanne. So let me say it clean. They were 7. They were twins, and they wanted a door that didn't shake. When Palestinians are alive, the world refuses to see them as children. And when they're dead, the world refuses to see them as anything else. So let me speak of them alive, stacking bottle caps into towers and calling them buildings, naming them after neighborhoods to keep the places safe, choosing yellow clips, pouring tea into a palm so that your sister doesn't go without. This is what was taken. That's what was erased when headlines turned family into collateral. This entire episode is about clarity, and when a mother identifies her child by an ankle scar because his face is gone, what's left is evidence of how far they'll go to erase a child. A boy with a backpack is not a combatant. They call him male subject. His mother called him by the scar on his ankle. He was 12. His backpack held math homework and a half-eaten sandwich. If a 5-year-old anywhere is a child, then a 5-year-old here is a child. Build your politics from that sentence or admit that they're not fit for children. This has been Palestine Exists. I'm Hiba. Until next time, Palestine exists, and so do Palestinian children. Say their names.